Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. Now, it's funny when people say to me, what's the most valuable thing you own? I always look to the stars and say to myself, it's my network. It's the power of the network. And I met an incredible lady called Diana Markaki, who created the first private club for women members who want to be board members. And this initiative is now really catching fire across Europe in relation to what it does, why it does it, and the purpose behind the initiative itself. Now, that purpose always comes from one person, really, doesn't it? The founder, the person who had the idea in the first place. So join me just after this break where I talk to the person behind the boardroom, Diana Markaki. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to The Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Diana, it's a huge warm welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
I'm doing great, Adam. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
We've spoken many times, Diana, and we haven't quite managed yet to align being in the same country at the same time.
I think that is true.
I know you're living in Switzerland at the moment. You're not there right now. But every time I come to Switzerland, you're in London. If you're in London, I'm in Switzerland. So in some ways, we've been ships in the night for many, many months. But it's good to connect virtually.
Likewise.
Now, I did a very brief introduction in relation to what you're doing at the moment, but just tell everyone what it is you're doing right now, and then I want to go backwards a little bit in relation to, you know, where this has all come from and what is fueling your passion for the boardroom. So just tell everyone at the moment, what's the initiative for you?
Well, I'm definitely very passionate about the boardroom, and I became an entrepreneur overnight, but that's a title that I would like to keep for the rest of my life if possible. So I am the founder of the boardroom, which, as you said, is the first private club for women executives who aspire to become board members. So that started, I think, like every passion project, with me trying to solve a problem for myself, right? So a few years ago, I received my first external board assignment. Right. So I was 36 at the time. I was quite young for a listed board appointment. It was in the construction industry, very male dominated. I was one of only two women on the board. So I really wanted to become the best board member anyone had ever met, because obviously in circumstances like this, we're the youngest and the only of one of two women, you don't want to be challenged for your credentials or your experience. So I started looking at what does it really mean to be a successful board member. So I started doing board education, coaching, leadership development, networking. But then I very quickly realized it's almost impossible on top of a full-time executive job to actually do everything that I need to do for me to become a successful board member. So I decided to build a solution for myself that would actually limit the time and effort in order for me to take the next step. And that's how the boardroom came about. I was doing my executive MBA at Harvard Business School at the time. And what's the best place to actually build an idea like that when you have the 190, you know, biggest minds of the world? So when we go to Harvard, as you probably know, we're asked to bring a problem, right? So since I was very passionate about the topic at the time, I decided to bring the problem. How do you go from being a successful executive, so you made it to the top, to becoming a successful board member? So the solution that we built is what we call today the boardroom, which is the holistic approach to board readiness.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I have so many questions already. Because, and that's the curious lawyer in me, which is a great segue, because you're also a qualified lawyer as well, aren't you, Diana?
Yes, I am. So I was a hardcore lawyer, as my friends used to call me, for more than 20 years.
Right.
So I started as a lawyer. I'm originally from Greece, from Athens, in case, you know, anyone could not tell by my Greek accent.
and you're in Greece now, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I'm enjoying the Greek summer.
I bet.
Yes. So I started my career as an international lawyer, actually in New York. So I was trained as a lawyer in New York more than 20 years ago. Then I did my first master's at NYU. I worked at the United Nations in New York. I did the whole New York tour, I guess, that a lot of us did in our early 20s. And then after New York, I've worked in London, Athens, Milan, Amsterdam. Maybe I'm missing a few. But as you said, for the past 10 years, I work and live in Zurich in Switzerland. But then I moved from law to business. So I'm not a practicing lawyer anymore, Adam.
You're a recovering lawyer, Diana,
I'm
like
a recovering lawyer, yes. But as you know, once a lawyer, always a lawyer.
I know.
So I still think as a lawyer, which actually helped me a little bit, you know, more than expected in business. So as I mentioned, I did my executive MBA at Harvard Business School, which helped me actually transition from law to business. So for the past few years, I work in business. I've worked in the oil and gas industry. I was a project director at the Transadriatic Pipeline Project. I was, you know, in asset management. I worked at Gate Group in Zurich. And then I decided to actually, you know, give up everything to follow my passion, which, as I said, is, you know, the boardroom, which helps women executives become successful board members.
Right. And I want to ask many questions about the boardroom, because that's something that I know that Hydrogen Struggles are now going to support as you've extended into London. We'll come back to that. So here's a question I want to ask you. My wife is a lawyer, and she was a partner in a law firm for a while. So perhaps I had some experience of watching her up close and personally trying to balance a career in law, but also trying to be a mum with two children and all of the associated pressures that go with it. When people are listening to this, Diana, you're an international lawyer. You've lived in New York, London, Athens, Milan. You've done an executive MBA with Harvard. You have phenomenal credentials. So did you still feel that even with those credentials, you were at a disadvantage as a female in business, in a boardroom? Tell us a little bit about what that was like, because your credentials are here on the page in front of me.
Yes, and that is a really tricky situation to be in, Adam, because what we face as successful women executives is the response that, but you made it, you are successful, and you are a woman. So what's the problem in that? I mean, you know, you made it. So why are you talking about, you know, gender inequality in business, or, you know, gender barriers for women in business? So the fact that we actually made it to the top, and there are, you know, quite a few amazing women that made it to the top of organizations, became partners at law firms or C-level executives in large organizations, yeah, does not mean that there is an absence of gender bias, gender inequalities in business. We need to think about it. What greater heights would these women have reached in the absence of all these gender biases, stereotypes that are holding women back in business? And also, how many more amazing women would have made it to the top if we were lacking all these, you know, issues in the work environment? So the fact that some women, despite all these issues and, you know, despite all the odds being against them, they made it, having made sacrifices, personal and otherwise, that I think we should not be making, does not mean that these problems, you know, do not exist.
What was the catalyst for you? You may have alluded to this already, Diana, but what was the catalyst for you that you would give up? Well, in some ways, give up your legal work, but combine the legal education with the MBA to become passionate about. Because you became an entrepreneur, as you say, overnight, and you started the boardroom in 2021, yes, which didn't exist. So you took a personal risk. Was there something that was quite defining for you that you thought, I have to do this? Yes, I have
absolutely
to take this risk.
Yes. It can only be a case like this, where you feel compelled that you have no option.
Right.
So when I actually decided to give up everything and dedicate literally my life in this cause, in this mission, it's one of those decisions that you feel like you have to do it. I cannot, you know, keep on with my career and my life and enjoying my privileges, because it all starts by us acknowledging the privileges that we have. And I do come from a privileged environment. So indeed, you know, I had the opportunity to go to the best universities, to study abroad, to go to, you know, Ivy League schools, you know, travel around the world and have the support of a family environment to actually allow me to do that. And other women, but also men, do not come from that point of privilege that would help them accelerate their career. So I started by acknowledging my privilege and I said, I do come from this privileged environment. I was given all these opportunities. I have two options, either continue accelerating my career and enjoying all of the benefits that I have earned through that hard work, or use that power, use that experience, use my network and connections to actually help other people, particularly women, that do not have those opportunities. So when I was a lawyer, I was actually getting trained to manage risks, right? That's what we do. Yep. Then I decided that I want to jump into more of, you know, making decisions. And that's why I moved into business, to be able to not only give advice, but to actually use my own advice to make business decisions. And then once I started my board career, and as I said, you know, me being one of only two women on the board made no sense, because for sure I'm not the smartest and most successful woman that I know. So I immediately realized there's something wrong. This is not how things would be. So then I decided to make things better for the women after me. I had already made a lot of sacrifices, personally and professionally, that I don't want any other woman to take after me. And right. I want to leave a legacy behind me that says, looking at the boardroom like the golden standard for women executives, to help them stay in positions of power and then accelerate to the next step. So I said, I'm giving up everything. I'm going to commit to my passion and my mission, which is to increase the number of qualified women on corporate boards.
And I appreciate you making reference to, as you say, identifying and accepting the privilege that you had, that you were able to travel the world. You were going to some of the best educational institutions that money can buy, really, in many
exactly.
ways.
Exactly.
So is there a social mobility element to the boardroom as well, in order to increase accessibility for women, maybe who have not come from such a privileged background, to still avail themselves to the services, to the influence, to the network in order to succeed? Was there an element of that in your mind as well?
Yes. And this is actually a very good time to mention that, because so we just celebrate our 2-year anniversary at the boardroom.
As I said, we are,
you know, yes, thank you. So we're a mission driven startup, right? And everything is basically based on the support of our network and organizations with power. So we started for the first 2 years working mostly with large corporations, large employers that have the means, financial and others, to actually help women within the organization to take the next step. And that is, you know, if you have experience in the startup world, the first thing that you need to do is actually make sure that your mission-driven startup actually can survive and create the power to continue existing. So the first 2 years was us focusing on working with large employers and organizations to support the women within their career ranks.
And that was out of Zurich, Diana, is that right?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So now we work with more than 100 large companies that are present around Europe and across the world, but we're currently focused on Europe.
Yes.
So now that we have established the power that we need, we will start helping women that actually don't have those large employers and the financial means, although they have the expertise and the experience and the industry and functional knowledge to become successful board members, to be able to join the boardroom. So over the next 2 years, so we will be focusing on helping those women that unfortunately we were not able to help during the first phase of our startup, because we were focusing on large organizations and women executives from those large organizations.
So that's interesting. So really you focused on the arena that you knew well, which was large. And
large
you
corporates.
You used the word that they had the power. And let's be honest.
Exactly.
The power, the influence and the finances in order to get the initiative off the ground and for it to become sustainable. So I understand that. But let me go to the start. It's 2021. And you decide you need to do something about this, about providing a private club for women members who want to be board members. How do you get this off the ground? Because this has to go from a thought or even a business plan to a reality. Now, I know that you've done a huge amount in 2 years, and we'll come on to that. But how do you get the initial inertia or buy-in? Because at the moment, we always say, don't you, well, at the start, you're a founder with a crazy idea, and you
yes.
have to try and find followers, supporters, input.
Yes.
Okay, tell me about that. How do you get off ground zero to get this going?
Yeah. Well, I wish I could share like an amazing, you know, marketing strategy to actually share in business schools around the world. And I had just graduated, as I said, from Harvard Business School. But unfortunately, this is not the reality. So as I said, I became an entrepreneur by accident overnight. This was not planned. I'd still had my full-time executive role. At that time, we were, you know, in the middle of the pandemic.
Right.
You know, we had the lockdown. You know, everyone was at home. You know, most of my teams were actually, you know, put on, you know, furlough, so they were not working. So it was a situation where we were going from heavy traveling, a lot of meetings, to being stuck at home. So that was, just to put things into perspective, that was the moment where I actually start, you know, kicking this this off. On a personal level, I had just lost my father during the pandemic, which was, you know, a very big hit for me emotionally. And I was starting, you know, rethinking my life, you know, what am I doing? What am I giving? What am I going to leave behind? So then January 2021, I just published a LinkedIn post. That was it. It was just me going to, like, you know, all my network on LinkedIn saying, this is my dream. This is my ambition. This is what I want to do. You know, who's with me? So that was my brilliant marketing strategy. Just being honest and vulnerable during the pandemic and announcing to everyone. And Adam, you will be surprised. Within literally a few days, I had hundreds of messages coming in, mostly from people that they did not know. Because I had been in Switzerland at the time for, you know, let's say 7-8 years, but I was, you know, living in an expat bubble. If you're an expat in Switzerland, basically you're just like hanging out with the other, you know, international, you know, expats. So I really didn't know many people in the country, although I had been around for a while. So it was just like me sharing a LinkedIn post with the world, really. And then I had hundreds of women actually coming to me. I love your idea. Let's jump on a call. So everyone actually jumping on video calls during that time because we were not traveling. We were at, you know, we were at home. We had less meetings and we were just experimenting with Zoom and Teams. And then within a few days, I had, you know, my first amazing team of founding members that actually are still with me today at the boardroom. We're just starting, as I said, our third year in Switzerland. We're expanding across Europe. We have already 4 countries. I mean, I was working all my life for large corporations. I was, you know, my last job, as I said, was group head of assets management when I had 400 locations under me. And we were not able to open a new country earlier than in like 3-4 years. And now the boardroom actually opens physical locations, what we call the private clubhouse. You know, almost like 2 a year, which means that there's a lot of support, you know, there's a lot of, you know, momentum around this. And as you said, we're bringing everyone together. We're not, you know, women talking to women. We actually bring, you know, the large corporations with us, you know, the men, the women, the recruiters like Heidrick and Struggles and many others.
Now, we talked about your expansion as well. And it is incredible how, as you say, you put out a LinkedIn post, suddenly you find a tribe of people who are like-minded. Well, there's the power of social media for you. but how do you actually go from a good idea, a group of you who are founding it, but then this needs finances as well. This actually needs finances and it needs real support from real organizations to create real sustainable change. Because I know you've got, as you said, physical clubhouses in Switzerland, in Greece, in London. I think you've got one now as well, which
in
I'm
Denmark.
Looking forward to see. In Denmark. How do you go from good idea, super excitement, founders to reality? What was the thing that happened that made it a reality where you knew, okay, this is going to happen?
Yes, it does take a lot of support and it takes financial support. So we are a bootstrapping, mission-driven startup.
Fits
it doesn't get... so there's like no VC funding, there's like no investors behind it. We would never go down that route because, as I said, I want to stay very authentic and true to my mission. And everything is associated, as I said, with my family name, with myself. And I will never do anything to jeopardize that reputation that, as I said, started with me honoring my father to actually going through for the rest of my life. So it does take financial support. So the first thing that I did is actually talk to my family and I said, look, are you willing to actually invest our present and our future? Because it, you know, it is like all our future, you know, pension and everything you can imagine into what I want to do for the rest of my life. So it actually took a family to agree on investing everything that we have now and for the future in order for me to try to make the world better. So it started with me being the only investor and shareholder to the day by investing my own money. When people saw that I was so passionate, and I'm still extremely passionate about the mission and what I want to achieve while making the world better, and people understood that, well, if she's really willing to risk 23 years of career, give up, you know, the luxury of the executive roles and the support, you know, putting in all the financial future of her family, then she can she really means it, you know, means it. So people then started actually investing financially, like large corporations, in what they thought that was a true mission on my side, where I was willing to risk everything, including my future, to make things better for women after me.
So you, in many ways, had to be the initiator of it and the role model for it. Now, that's an enormous risk, Diana.
You know,
so tell me a little bit about that decision to risk everything. As you say, 23 years worth of a career, the stability of an executive job, the financial input that you looked at. I asked that question because I'm sorry to hear that you lost a parent in the pandemic, and I did as well. So that really resonates with me. But you've used a word a couple of times, legacy.
Yes.
And I'm assuming there's something behind that, that the legacy that you want for you and your family is linked to the passion and is linked to the commitment and risk that you took. Now that's me putting two and two together, Diana. But tell me a little bit about that, the personal element behind your all in.
Absolutely. So I think that comes through, you know, the way that, you know, I grew up, the way that I was brought up. So my father always told me, you carry your family name. So whatever you do in the world actually reflects on all of us. So I grew up actually having in mind that everything I don't do it for myself. I do it while my father and my mother and my brother actually feel proud when I represent the family name. So it has guided me through this day. And the biggest thing that I can lose is not money or shelter or a roof over my head, is my family reputation. So I would not do anything to actually jeopardize that reputation. And when we're also talking about, you know, independent board members, I try to remind people that being an independent board member has one actual safety pin in it. Are you willing to actually put yourself forward and risk your reputation as a professional when you're raising the hand in a board meeting saying, I disagree, this is not right, I'm stepping down? That's the only way you're truly independent as a board member, not legally or financially only, but also your name. You're putting up your reputation, and that's where I trust you to be an independent board member and be true to the organization by willing to step down just for you not to ruin that reputation. So I don't see, and I will never see, the boardroom as a business. And that's why I think a lot of mistakes that startups do. So maybe I was too old to become a founder and an entrepreneur.
Oh, no, Diana.
Well, usually you see this, you know, young, you know, 23, 24 year old people that actually have not much to lose, right? So they have not built a career. They have not, you know, lived in, you know, luxury environments. I can always go back to sleeping on the couch of a friend. I had a lot to lose, right? So if you don't see it as a business, but you see it as something that means you're being true to yourself. So I had to make one decision. How do I want to spend the rest of my life? What would make me proud? What is the title that I want to keep with me once I'm gone? I had spent 23 years making a lot of money from large organizations. I was in the oil and gas, construction, and real estate industry. Right. I was making a lot of rich people much richer, and I was actually part of the system. When you realize that you're part of the system, and also acknowledging your privileges, you realize that you're part of the problem. So realize by not changing the system, by actually accepting things that I knew were wrong, by not fighting back, I was actually not only not being part of the solution, but I was also part of the problem. So then I decided to use that power for the better. And the risks, financial or otherwise, would actually not make me lose my sleep as much as I would lose my sleep if I continued contributing to this inequality. And again, we're going back to the pandemic. During the pandemic, Adam, a lot of women executives were the ones that were losing their jobs, not only because they were let go, but also because they were quitting, because they were stuck at home without any child support, with their husbands, you know, that were used to traveling to actually, you know, continue being throughout the pandemic at home. So they were suffering. So we were actually looking at years of sacrifices of women executives that made it to the top against all odds to actually being, you know, going backwards. So we were in a situation where it became an urgent matter for us to address. So as a woman executive at that time, I felt the sense of urgency to do something now or then be silent forever. I would not be able to complain for inequalities if I fail to do something during that critical period of the world, which was the pandemic.
The pandemic was a deeply personal experience for all of us, Diana, and we've touched upon some of the experiences that you and I have had at a personal level. Did the pandemic magnify the problem as far as you were concerned? Was that in some way a moment in time where it just highlighted to you that if I'm going to do this, I'm doing this now?
Exactly. Absolutely. So I think that if that had not happened, first of all, on a personal and professional level, I would never have the opportunity to actually test it out. Right. So I had, as we said, this great idea. The idea was great. We had spent, you know, 2 years actually building the best solution. But in reality, we were never planning on actually launching it. It was, you know, my personal business case at HBS. It could have stayed in the drawer. It was not something that I was planning on building as a business, right? But during that moment, during the pandemic, then I really felt the sense of urgency. All the inequalities were actually rising up. And I could see women actually, you know, becoming more and more, let's say, less patient about those inequalities. So as I said, I felt that either I would do something now or I would have to stay silent forever.
Now, tell me a little bit about, because there are some directives, aren't there, European directives in relation to a female representation on boards. Just help us understand a little bit about some of those, because obviously you're using those in relation to your growth and your focus. Help us understand, just in general terms, some of those directives.
Yes. So we have the European Women on Boards Directive that was unlocked after 10 years at the European level, that requires 40%, you know, representation of, you know, the underrepresented gender, which in this case is women, on boards of listed companies. And I'm not going to go into the details of you know, the legal requirements around it, but it is a push at the European level to actually increase the number of women on boards. We had over the past 10 years several European countries that had similar requirements and regulations on, you know, gender equality on corporate boards. But as a lawyer, I don't want regulators to intervene in business. As a woman, I don't want anyone to even imply that I received any board appointment due to my gender. So in principle, we wish we did not have to actually go into a solution like gender quotas on corporate boards.
Right.
But we have waited for hundreds of years to actually see any change from large corporations to do what is right. Because senior female leaders do not lack talent. They don't lack qualifications. They're not less smart, experienced, or qualified by their male peers. What they do lack is the resemblance to what is perceived as the normal face of leadership. So when you think about a CEO or a senior female leader, an experienced board member, definitely what comes into your mind, I assume, is not someone like me. So what we want to do is actually change the social perspective of that inequality, not the legal or regulatory. Having said that, gender quotas are a mandatory, temporary regulation, because otherwise we will not be able to see any change. But when you put in place such regulations that actually require listed companies to have board members based on gender criteria, you need to make sure that you have a pipeline, a pool, a mechanism to actually find, prepare, place, and support women in these positions. So unless you have a pool of qualified women executives that have the support once they get appointed on the board, this could easily very much backfire. Because although as an individual, a senior female leader is qualified to be a board member, they're absolutely qualified. Once they're appointed on a board, then you need to look at the collective suitability of the board. How does the board culture change or is impacted by the addition to this, let's say, diverse talent, because they're not used to actually managing diversity? And managing diversity is very difficult because it promotes disagreement. So board discussions are becoming longer. Then you need to actually look at things from different perspectives because we're solving the groupthink and issue. So when I decided to launch the boardroom, I said, there is a sense of urgency, not only for the business inequalities that I mentioned, and we were losing women executives, but also because that month, the same month that we actually launched, we had the European Women on Boards Directive that were pushing organizations to place more women. And I said, before we start imposing those regulations, we need to make sure that we support the women, we place them, we make sure that the board accepts that diversity so that we're all very successful.
Now, Diana, this is interesting. Am I right in thinking that actually a directive could almost be a double-edged sword, that a directive could provide inertia, but also a directive could make some people think that positions are only being filled because of regulation and not because of ability? Is that a fair comment?
Yes, it is, unfortunately.
Right.
Because although we say merit is not negotiable, so when you're appointing any woman on any board, we're not negotiating on merit. Unless she's the right person for the right position, then she's not appointed.
Right.
But from an unconscious bias perspective, there is a huge risk that every time we see a board appointment to be a woman, then subconsciously, a lot of people think, oh, she was appointed just because of her gender, because we have the regulation. And that's why we say that, unfortunately, as women, we need to try and work double as hard in order to receive half of the credit.
I'm with you. And so my next question is, what's the major blockage or barrier or challenge that you find yourself working with at the moment in the boardroom? What is that thing that you're fighting against? The
change of culture, Adam.
Okay. Tell me more.
So what we're trying to do is basically change the culture that has been built over generations across the world. And we're trying to do this country by country. And a change of culture, as you can imagine, takes time because it was built over generations. But we are also very frustrated. So you see a lot of, you know, women have been fighting for 20, 30 years. So at this point, they said, like, I have no time, you know, to make excuses. I cannot wait anymore. You know, I have, you know, fought for this and I want things to change overnight. So they're losing patience. But we need to understand that a culture that was built over generations cannot change overnight. And it cannot change at least only through regulation, because as you said, that regulation could actually have also the opposite social effect and increase all the stereotypes and the unconscious bias that she received that position, not because she is worth it, but because she is a woman. So we're trying to change the culture in every country that we go in. And that's why we bring everyone together. You cannot change a culture of a country, if it's just women talking to women, or if it's just women complaining against men. So we're building bridges, Adam, instead of creating silos. But the way that I see the boardroom is building a bridge between qualified women executives, large organizations that want to increase the diversity, male supporters, which is what we call men in positions of power that appreciate the importance of diversity, recruiters like Heidrick & Struggles that know what's the right thing to do, or they want to promote talent irrespective of gender. So we're bringing everyone together to change the culture that was built over generations.
And that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because you said that this is not just women talking to women, it's men and women. So tell me what you've done in relation to that. Because as you say, if you're trying to change a culture, it's all voices that you need.
Absolutely.
So tell us the importance again of it's a conversation between men and women, even though this is a women members club to become board members, to promote people for board members. Tell me about that.
Correct. So we still don't accept men as members of the boardroom because we want to level the playing field for women executives. And I think we can do that for the next few years until we reach a point in time where we have almost gender balance at that board level.
Right.
The solution that we build with the boardroom, however, Adam, is a solution to improve corporate governance at the board level. So the solution that we're bringing is, how do we make boards better? The reason why we offer it for the time being only to women is because we want to use diversity and inclusion as a means to improve corporate governance. But once we've reached that point where we have almost gender balance at those top positions, then the solution that we're building should be open also to men. Yes, because our mission, as I said, is to improve corporate governance. So the solution that we're bringing is how an executive can become a successful board member independent of gender.
Understood.
In the meantime, and while we don't accept men as members, we do have them part of the solution, and we actually gave them a specific pillar because the boardroom is based on four pillars. So our third pillar is actually dedicated to men. And we also gave them a name because, you know, you want to be able to identify yourself once you're part of that solution. So we call them male allies. And male allies, as I said, are men in positions of power. So we're talking about top CEOs, experienced board members, recruiters, you know, consultants, advisors, men that have the power to make a change. And they want to use that power in order to make things better for both genders, because gender equality is good for both genders. And that's why we call them male allies. So male allies started, as I said, at the beginning of our startup journey, where they were the CEOs of large listed companies with a big budget, right? So we brought them in as, you know, men that wanted to support the boardroom. They were using, you know, the financial and other power they had as CEOs of those large organizations to promote women within their company. Now, then the second part of the male allies is basically where we give them the opportunity to experience life, what it means to be part of a diverse board. And this is what we call our board meeting simulations.
Right.
So the board meeting simulations are currently the signature event of the boardroom because we use that event in order to allow men and women to experience a diverse board meeting. So we do this board meeting simulation with our male allies at the stock exchanges across Europe. So we had one in London a couple of months ago. We're doing it in Switzerland, in Athens, in Madrid. So we're doing it across Europe, where we bring together the male allies and the members of the boardroom, where they act as a board of directors, for them to understand the beauty of the discussions. We're at the table. In a board meeting, you have diverse voices, not only of gender, because the women not only bring the gender diversity, but usually they also bring the functional expertise diversity. So women are usually, you know, focused on, you know, legal, compliance, sustainability, and other functional expertise that traditionally has not been dominated by men. So we bring them as part of that experience. And then, of course, you know, they bring to us board opportunities. I mean, what a better way to help each other. So currently, 90% of the board opportunities that we're handling at the boardroom in Switzerland actually came through the male allies. So this is where a male CEO or a board chair came to us and said, look, I have an opening and I want to fill it with a top female executive. So they always make, you know, requests or nominations and referrals within our community to actually put the right people in the right positions.
That's the power of the network.
Yes.
Okay. And in relation to the boardroom, when you first started it, was this something that didn't exist or it existed in a way that just wasn't fit for purpose? What was there?
So that's a very good question because, you know, obviously, you know, we did not decide to actually, you know, spend 2-3 years of our life actually, you know, building something that exists. As I said, it started with me trying to solve a problem for myself. So when I wanted to become a successful board member, I joined all the networks that were out there. I attended all the education that was available. I was doing, you know, networking like crazy, coaching and leadership development. But then I realized that none of this could work, firstly, because it was not put together in a strategic, combined way with a specific mission. So me doing board education on my own and then attending networking events and then joining online networks. So nothing worked for me.
Right.
So what we did basically is, and we call it the holistic approach, we took the best of what existed, we put it together in a one-stop-shop approach, and we build it under a private club community to leverage the strength of the community. So basically, the boardroom is a combination of the YPO, because we're built on that mentality of being a community of leaders that stay together for years to come.
Right.
Soho House, because we have these beautiful private clubhouses. The Institute of Directors, because we have this amazing board opportunity and board education. You know, the Harvard Business School, because we have our second pillar, which is a leadership development program. And we do that all together in a female network atmosphere, which is not online, it is in person, because we want to accelerate the relationship building. So basically, we took the best of what was out there, we put it together in a one-stop-shop approach, and we built that as a community to leverage the strength.
Right, okay. So you took the best of what you could see or not see
and, yes,
and put that together. So it's your second anniversary of the boardroom, as I say.
Yes.
So it's still only been a couple of years. Help people understand. So how many countries are you in now?
So we are fully operational in 4 countries. We're opening 2 more this year. So it's going to be Switzerland, Greece, Denmark, UK, France, and Belgium, and then 6 more countries next year.
Wow.
So we actually have a 12-country rollout plan in Europe, because we want to first become the pan-European golden standard for women executives that want to be board members with the support of the largest companies plus the male allies. And once we complete that journey, and you know, Europe is, you know, as you say, every country is different. It's different legislation, it's different language, it's different culture. So it's actually, you know, a lot of work, but
yes,
it has a huge impact in the world. Then the second step is for us to go to the US. So then the US will be a separate project. So we're going to be a pan-European plus US golden standard for women executives that want to be board members.
Wow, I love that as a plan for world domination.
Yes.
The start of it. Listen, what do you want your legacy to be, Diana? That's important to you. You know, if I shuttle forward 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, what do you want your legacy to be?
So I would like to help women after me achieve their dreams, whatever these are, without having to make the sacrifices that I made. So I don't want all women to be board members. I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't want to push any woman to have a career or to become a senior executive or even a board member, unless that's her dream. But if that is her dream and she has the qualification to achieve that dream, I don't want her to make all the personal and professional sacrifices that I and many other women in my generation had to make. So I want to make it easier for the next generation of female leaders to achieve their potential and their dreams.
Understood. And let's just kind of finish off with this. Heidrick & Struggles are going to be proud supporters,
yes,
of the boardroom. So tell everyone a little bit about what Heidrick & Struggles and the boardroom will help to do together, or would hope to do together, now that you're in London.
Yes. So we start with London, which is very exciting. And we have already expanded also to Denmark and France. So Heidrick & Struggles hopefully will be the global partner of the boardroom while we actually accelerate that growth across Europe. So we actually partner with organizations like Heidrick & Struggles that believe in senior talent, irrespective of gender. So we're looking at C-level executives that want to become successful board members, but we want to be gender blind. So we don't want, obviously, to, as I said, promote based on gender. So we don't want to accelerate or increase a problem that existed, but we want to be gender blind when it goes to senior talent. So with Hydrogen Struggles, they have all these amazing connections with women that fulfill the criteria to become successful board members in terms of experience, industry knowledge, functional expertise, and leadership style, because we're also looking at the personality to actually help them build that confidence, because that's the only thing that we're lacking at this stage. We have the experience, we have the industry knowledge and functional expertise, but sometimes we lack the confidence because we don't have other role models. We don't see enough women on corporate boards to say, this is something for me. So Hydrogen Struggles actually help us identify that senior talent that qualified to become board member. Well, then we have...
It's exciting because I know I'll personally be part and parcel of, I hope, the team that will be with you and see some of these steps take place in the UK.
Exactly. And then we have, our board education. As I said, we have built this 5-module curriculum, which is all the education that we need as executives for the next step. And part of that education, we have a very practical module where we call it how to get on a board. So once you have actually covered, the board governance, the legal framework, the finance, and all the other technical elements of being a board member, then how do you actually get on a board? So we work with Hydrogen Struggles and yourself and other members of your team to actually prepare that practical step of getting on a board. So like building a board profile, our elevator pitch, getting ready for interviews for board members. So what does it really take practically to become a board member once you have become a successful executive? So that's a very important part of our partnership as well.
No, that's great. And a big shout out, because I know that Alice Breeden and Kit Bingham will very much. They're also looking forward to this relationship and seeing where we can take things. Listen, Diana, you're doing great things. I know you also got Businesswoman and Social Entrepreneur Award in Monaco recently.
was a great surprise.
So congratulations to you. I've just come back from Monaco. So well done
Thank
to you.
You.
I don't know how that's relevant to the conversation, but there we go. Listen, how can people get in touch with you or the boardroom, because they want to be part of the conversation? They're female leaders who would love to understand and be part of the network. They're male allies who want to support the cause. How do they get in touch, Diana?
So I want everyone to actually reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm a huge supporter of LinkedIn. Obviously, as I said, we started this mission, this exciting journey through LinkedIn. So I'm a very loyal, actually, supporter of LinkedIn. So anyone can reach out to me on my LinkedIn profile, send me a message. Then you can always visit our website. We always, update it with the new countries that we're opening. Yep. So the website of the boardroom is always a great place to get more information, as well as by email. We have our email on the website. You can also reach out to us by email. So LinkedIn, website, and email is the best way to reach out to us.
Okay, so let's help you. What's the address of the website?
So it's the-boardroom.ch. CH is for Switzerland.
Fine, gotcha. And we'll put that in the show notes. And I'll put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes as well, so that people can get hold of you directly. And Diana, I know that you and I will be meeting at some point in the not too distant future.
Yes.
I know we'll be working together, as you are now in London. All of that is incredibly exciting. I just want to say a big thank you for taking the time to come on to the Leadership Enigma. Maybe we'll do this again, but you'll come into the studio, Diana.
Yes,
next
please.
Time.
It looks great. Yeah.
How about that?
Thank you very much for having me, Adam.
It's a
I really
pleasure.
Enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Enjoy your holiday, and I'll speak to you very soon. Take care.
Thank you. Bye, Adam.
Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.